Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome everyone. Well, last week we talked with Dr. Henslin about the brain in love, about what it looks like and how that affects our moods and our behaviors. So I thought it would be interesting today to follow that up by talking to two relationship experts who've not only been married for 38 years themselves, but they spent 2 years interviewing other couples to find out the secrets of lasting marriage. Dr. Henslin had told us that he's done over 50,000 brain scans and found that that giddy, I'm in love state only lasts about 18 months. And so I thought it would be good to follow that up with some conversations or tips from conversations of people who've been together many, many years and how they have stayed happy. And one thing I promise you is we are not going to talk about Tiger Woods and his marriage or any other celebrity marriage today. That's coming up around 12:30. But first, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. David Doser. We've talked about dogs here before. We've talked about them in films, in books, as therapy, and the science of their behavior. And today we're talking about one of their feline counterparts, Oscar. And I have to tell you that Oscar is a cat with a very special gift. Dr. David Doser is a geriatrician and assistant professor of medicine at the Warren Alpert School of Brown University. He wrote an essay for the New England Medical Journal, which became the premise for his new book. And that book is called Making the Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat. Dr. David Doser, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm very good. I'm pleased you're with us today. This was such an interesting story to read about. I want to just begin, Dr. Doser, by talking a little about you're a geriatrician. There are only 7,000 geriatricians in America, as I understand it. And you kind of broke with family tradition because the rest of your family were all podiatrists. Why did you go into geriatrics?
The rest of my family is actually pediatricians. So,
that's what I meant to say. Yeah.
I went into geriatrics because I really appreciate the patients that I care for and the stories that they have to tell. And in the book, I suggest that I went into pediatrics because kids are sort of like blank canvases, while my patients tend to be finished canvases, and the stories that they have to tell are often remarkable, and I learn a lot from them. So it really, in my mind, makes my job more interesting than some of my colleagues who care for the younger age groups.
Mm. And you work at a nursing home rehabilitation center. Tell us a little bit about that, what it's like for you working in that environment.
Well, Steerhouse is a nursing home here in Providence, Rhode Island. It's a 120-bed nursing home that cares for patients after they're hospitalized for hip fractures or various illnesses. But they also take care of dementia patients, and they have two wards that are essentially dedicated to dementia care, one that's more subacute and one that's sort of what we call a later-stage dementia unit or a terminal dementia unit, where the patients are very advanced. And that's actually where Oscar is. He's on the advanced dementia unit on the third floor of the nursing home. So.
And Oscar is the resident cat. He was adopted, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, Oscar has been with us at the nursing home for almost 5 years now. He was adopted from a shelter, and I guess he was the brightest and bushiest tail of the bunch. He came up to the nurse who was looking at the cats, and so he became one of our animal companion cats, along with a sister cat by the name of Maya.
And he's a black and white tabby, as I understand it. You say he's a cute little guy with attitude. And when you first got there, he was there before you. You said you weren't really a cat lover. But he's grown on you, right?
he's grown on me. I was actually talking to my grandparents on the phone last night, and we were talking about the book. And in the book, I sort of make reference to an episode how I was sort of traumatized by a cat that they had growing up, and they were somewhat surprised, but I guess it was a little bit of a repressed memory. But this cat used to terrorize me every time I would go visit. He would refuse to let me up the stairs and would hiss at me and sort of swipe at me. And I guess that left an impression because I wasn't much of a cat person when I started this journey. And Oscar certainly initially didn't leave that much of an impression on me. He really kept out of sight. And for the most part, you would have trouble finding him. He would be under a bed somewhere or behind a medicine trolley, just generally keeping out of sight.
Mm. And he has quite a story behind him, a story that you were very skeptical about when you first got there. Share that story with us and how it came about.
Well, Oscar, again, not a very friendly cat. He's certainly not a lab cat and not one that spends a lot of time with family members or even the staff on the unit. He keeps to himself. And we, certainly during the early part of his life in the nursing home, had a great deal of difficulty finding him. But then he started to make these visits. And as we found out, the visits kind of gained in frequency, that his visits were really vigils that he was holding for patients at the very end of life, and really the only patients he would hang out with or spend significant time with were the ones that were on their way out and in the dying process.
Now, you say he had a couple of ways of doing this. Sometimes he'd wait at their door to be let in. Other times he'd smell their feet. Has he ever got it wrong, David?
You know, there have been on occasion one or two episodes where Oscar hasn't been around. There's certainly been a number of cases where we've had him off the floor. Family members have asked us to take him off the floor, but he very rarely gets it wrong. I can't say that he's never missed, but he certainly hasn't missed recently, and he's been remarkably accurate. We assume that we think he's hit almost 60 deaths now on the unit, and that's pretty close to all the ones where he was around.
Mm. And I said at the beginning you were very skeptical of this story. You just brushed it aside and told the nurse not to repeat this. But what's your feeling now on this?
Well, I think I've become much more of a believer in this. It took a little while, but when you watch this happen over and over again, it becomes much harder to dismiss. And I think as we've had new staff on the floor, and everybody sort of starts out skeptical, and then they end up saying, "Oh my gosh, this cat really does do this." If you've been around it, it really is a remarkable thing, you know, to behold that this cat seems to know when people are on their way out.
Mm. Now, there was a story in the book, because you put this book together by talking with people, sharing stories of your own experiences and other people's experiences. And one of those stories involved a situation where there were two patients, and the nurses or the staff believed that patient B was mm-hmm. the most significant and most likely to die first, but Oscar disagreed. Tell us that story.
That actually, I think, is really what sort of drove it home for me. It was an episode or an occurrence where there were two patients dying, and as you suggest, there was one that we really thought was on their way. And Oscar was nowhere to be found, so one of the aides went looking for Oscar. By this point, he had a little bit of a streak going on, and we all thought he should be around. So she found Oscar on the other side of the unit with a patient that we knew was sick, but not one that we assumed was near death. And she picked the cat up and said, "Well, you're in the wrong place, bud." Walked him down the hallway and put him down on the bed, and he looked at everybody like they were all crazy and raced himself back to the first room, right back to the patient he was with. And that night, he was right. We were wrong. Oscar knew which patient was going to pass, sooner, and he was with the right patient. And the patient we all thought was very seriously ill rebounded a little bit and lived for another couple of days, maybe even a week. And a few hours before he died, Oscar was right back again.
Mm. So you come up with some possible solutions or possible reasons why this is happening. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd like to look at some of those reasons. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Dr. David Doser. His book is called Making the Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat. Please stay with us. In the year of the cat.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next Monday on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Beth Browse Scott shares her story from the frozen plains of Saskatchewan to the burning plains of Africa. Vicky also talks with memoirist Brenda Peterson about finding rapture here on Earth and New York Times best-selling novelist Robin Hobb on Volume 1 of the Rain Wilds Chronicles. Please join us Monday at noon Pacific for an adventurous Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Dr. David Doser. He's a geriatrician, and he's talking today about Oscar the Cat. He actually wrote a book based on Oscar the Cat. It's called Making the Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat. And as you heard in the first segment, he has this gift of knowing when people are going to die, and he'll go snuggle up with them during their last few hours. But you have a couple of theories that might explain why this happens. I wonder if you'd share those with us, David.
Yeah, you know, ultimately it's very hard to know exactly why he does what he does, and I've heard numerous theories from numerous people who study this a lot more closely than I do, animal behaviorists and people of this sort. My feeling is that Oscar is keying in on a smell of some form or a scent, whether it's a pheromone. Biologically, we know that cells, when they're closer to death, release ketones, which is the sweet-smelling scent that diabetics sometimes have on their breath when their sugars are really high. But we know that that happens also in starvation and other states. So it's very possible that that's what he's keying in on. I've heard of other people and other animals being able to pick up this quote-unquote smell.
My sister actually worked with elderly people for many years, and she stopped doing it. And one of the things she said constantly was she could tell when somebody was going to die because they would emanate a smell. Mm-hmm. Aroma, yeah.
And I think certain people can key in on that with greater acuity than others. I think if you know what you're trying to smell or you are around it quite often, you can key in on it. And certainly animals who generally have much better, more refined senses of smell can. But there's probably a behavioral element as well to what Oscar does. He gets praised now, obviously, when he's around. So he wants to be part of the team, and, you know, he's one of the family members, and I think he knows when he's needed. And we all have cats and dogs for exactly that reason, that they're there for us when we need them, and or most of them are, at least. And you know, I think you only need to ask an animal lover, you know, as to what their cat does or what their dog does when they're sick, and most of them will tell you, you know, he's right there with me, and he knows when I'm needed. So I don't think from a perspective of animals it's that unusual what he's doing. There's certainly other animals that do remarkable things, like sniff out cancer or predict seizures the animals, of course, that fled the tsunami or who had left long before the actual wave hit. So I think animals are in tune to certain things that we're not, and oftentimes, you know, if we listen to them a little bit more, perhaps we would know some of these things.
Yeah. So I read that this book began because you wrote an article for the New England Medicine. Is it? I don't have the exact name of the publication.
New England Journal of Medicine, yeah.
So how did that then evolve into this book?
Well, after the New England Journal of Medicine article went sort of live, it really took on a life of its own, and Oscar got this reputation of death cat, and really got the mantra of, if Oscar's on your bed, you're dead, and everybody was sort of fearful of him. But you know, interestingly enough, that's not what we were seeing in the nursing home, and obviously people approached me afterwards, are you going to write a book about this? And initially I was somewhat hesitant, but as this became more and more pervasive, I decided, well, you know, why don't I ask the family members and see what their feelings were of Oscar and what he meant to them? And strangely, despite the fact that one might be scared of a cat like this, the reality is that all of the family members told me how wonderful it was to have him around at the end of life, and he was a companion to them, or he was he was there so that people could go home at night and not worry if mom or dad were going to die that night, that they would be alone. So he's meant a lot to those family members, and I think really that's the remarkable thing. In the end, it doesn't really matter why he does what he does. The most important thing is he does what he does, and the family members are really thankful for that.
Yeah, and they definitely, as you said earlier, animals definitely pick up on our own behavior, and they do, I believe they sense. I mean, we interviewed a cognitive scientist not too long ago about dog behavior, not about cat behavior, but dog behavior. And the consensus was really that they just are really picking up on the behavior that the vibrations that we're emanating and the way we're behaving, but they definitely, I think, sense something along the way.
Definitely.
Now, you work at Steer House, as I said, nursing and rehabilitation center with mostly Alzheimer's patients, some other forms of dementia. I read, this was kind of shocking because it had gone up since I last read this, but there's over 5 million people in the U.S. with Alzheimer's and hundreds of thousands more with less common forms of dementia. What exactly is dementia? How is it different from Alzheimer's?
Well, I like to use this analogy because I think it sort of works, that Alzheimer's is a type of car. Dementia are all the cars on the road. So dementia is a loss of memory or a loss of brain cells related to whatever the process is. And Alzheimer's is just the most common form of dementia. So it's a type of dementia. We tend to use the words interchangeably, sometimes that actually works for us and other times against us. I think there are numerous forms of dementia. We tend to clump a lot of people together as having Alzheimer's disease, but really some of them are probably more vascular in nature. Others are related to diseases like Lewy body dementia, which I overview in the book. So Parkinson's disease can cause dementia. Alcoholism can cause dementia. So there are a variety of different causes. And ultimately, unfortunately, we don't have very good treatments for this, so it's never really in terms of being able to, you know, diagnose this or that. We can diagnose these diseases with a lot more acuity than we can actually treat them. So in the end, we diagnose them as being X, Y, or Z, but we treat them all the same. And that's the unfortunate reality of not having enough good treatments for these diseases.
Now, people often joke about when they get forgetful, oh, I'm getting senile dementia, which is, we know, is not a funny situation. But what is the difference? I mean, how do we know if we're really going down that road versus just being forgetful?
Yeah, well, I think we're all forgetful in our daily lives. And the important thing we need to remember is that there are a number of things that affect memory, sleep deprivation, depression, just our general health and well-being. We all know that if we, you know, when we were kids or in school, if we, you know, were out partying all night, we didn't do as well on the test the next day. So memory is a very fluid thing, and there are days where our memory works a lot better than other days, and it doesn't necessarily mean if you forget something that that you have dementia. But, you know, if it happens a lot, then obviously it probably makes sense to get a doctor's opinion. Memory disorders are not part of normal aging, and we should have it looked at, particularly if the memory disorder seems to be very troubling. And oftentimes it's just a matter of getting reinsurance from a doctor that, you know, look, you're not, because you left your keys, you know, in one area instead of another area, you're not getting dementia, you're not going senile, you're just, that's just normal.
Right.
But obviously, if you're losing your keys and finding them in the refrigerator, as we often joke, you know, that might mean a bigger problem. The other guiding principle that I use is if somebody else is concerned about your memory, I'm much more worried about that than if a patient comes in and says, I'm concerned about my memory. You know, if your husband or your wife is concerned about your memory, that's something you should listen to.
Okay. That makes sense, because if we were going down that road, we might not remember what it is we're forgetting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And dementia is also, particularly Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia, are personality diseases as well. So people's personality oftentimes changes. So if somebody gets very introverted or very hyper and they weren't like that before, and memory is also part of that, then, you know, that very well might be something that needs to be explored.
Mm. Something else you talk about is the sandwich generation, the baby boom generation, because we're sandwiched in between some of them caring still for children who are at home versus caring for elderly parents. And I think you've actually just come into that. Even though I don't think you're a baby boomer, but you are in that situation where you're caring for your wife's parent right now, I understand, correct?
Well, unfortunately, that's one of the things that, you know, has been part of this journey of writing the book, that my mother-in-law has been diagnosed with dementia and is on the younger side. She's only 66 and unfortunately already is in an assisted living. And it's been a very big struggle and one that obviously I see every day as a doctor who works with these types of patients, but it's very different when you go through it yourself and all of a sudden you have to listen to what you're preaching as opposed to just preaching it. So,
right.
It's a very big problem, and you know, we now have millions of Americans who are sort of stuck in the sandwich generation of caring for family, younger family and older family, and we don't have a very good healthcare system designed to help those people.
Mm. Now, at the end of the book, in the afterword, you give 5 tips to help make it through if you're caring for a loved one with dementia. Number one is taking care of yourself first, which I think is, you know, we hear a lot, but it's difficult sometimes for people to put into practice.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard, and it's one of those things that nobody, we say it, but you have to actually own it. One of the big things for me as a provider and as a physician is how often I see people really suffer in the caregiver role, and in some cases the caregivers are the ones to go first, and you're only as a caregiver as good as you can be if you're in a positive place yourself, and sometimes taking care of yourself means saying that I can't do it anymore, and that's really a lesson that I think, you know, needs to be, you know, learned by everybody who enters this particular part of life.
Right. Number two, you say, is be present, and you say that's one of the greatest gifts that Oscar the Cat teaches us, that the most important thing we can do for someone with dementia is to be there for them in the present.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really, you know, we don't get a lot of feedback from patients with dementia. They don't always thank us for being there. But yet, one of the most important things is really to be there. And that's where Oscar has been really good for us and showing us that, you know, we don't have anywhere else we really need to be. And these patients are our priority. And I think he's a good lesson to families as well, that, you know, they really don't need to be anywhere else. And nobody goes to their deathbeds, you know, worried about the promotion they didn't get. They all worry about, you know, was I there for family members? Was I there for the people who are closest to me? So I think that that's really a lesson that, you know, we all need to learn.
Okay. And celebrate the little victories, celebrate the little victories and see the big picture. You say that.
It's one of the hardest things to do because the general decline in Alzheimer's is pretty constant. But there are good days, and there are episodes where you see the old person or the person that used to be, and it's important to know that those are really the times you live for, and it's not something that you can hang on to because it will change. But it's really important to embrace those little victories and those little life. Fulfilling moments.
Right. Number four, you say become an advocate for high quality care, which, yes, we desperately need. And number five is love and let go.
Loving and let go is letting go is really one of the hardest things, and hopefully in the near future we'll have better treatments for this disease, and you know, we one day may look back at this like we did Staphylococcus or Streptococcus 100 years ago. Some of these were very much fatal diseases, but these days we prescribe an antibiotic and we take care of it. It's one of those things that we just have to do. We have to be able to let go, to be there for our loved ones, but at the end understand that dementia is a terminal disease, and these patients are dying with this disease, and life goes on despite the fact that a loved one might end up passing from this disease.
Right, and if they're lucky, they will have had Oscar cuddling up to them for the last few hours.
If they're lucky, yes.
What would you like to leave our listeners with? What do you want them to know about Oscar and your book today?
Well, I'd like everybody to, know that Oscar is not somebody to be feared or a cat. You know, he's not the kitty of death or the grim creeper or any of these monikers that he's
right.
earned over the years.
Baby.
Family members are really happy to have him around. And I think, what I'd like to suggest is that, we need to make these nursing homes more like homes. And having an animal companion program and animals like Oscar around is really something we ought to be striving for.
Yeah, definitely. And if listeners want to find out more about you, David, they can find you at daviddosa.com, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And I believe Oscar the Cat is actually on Facebook.
Oscar the Cat is on Facebook, and we try to update that site very regularly. So hopefully people will come and take a look and learn a little bit more about the book.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your story with us today, Dr. David Dosa.
Thank you for having me on.
And again, David's website is daviddosa.com. Dosa is D-O-S-A, daviddosa.com. And the book, again, is Making the Rounds with Oscar, The Extraordinary Gift of an Ordinary Cat. Not so ordinary, I don't think, but there you go. It's quite a touching thing to have around, I would think. Please stay with us. When we come back, we're joined by Linda and Charlie Bloom. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
Hi, I'm Terry with tsigns.com with a quick tip for you. Next time you're organizing an event, help unify your message and spread the word with great signage. Banners, flags, decals, t-shirts, and more can all be custom designed to give your event a unique look and feel. We're a family-run business who guarantees we'll beat any price and still give you great quality and personal service. See tsigns.com or call me today, Terry at tsigns.com, 206-971-6800. 206-971-6800.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk, 1150.
You and your pussycat knows.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live. I'm sorry, I'm laughing at the music that Eric was just playing. My next guests are marriage and relationship experts Charlie and Linda Bloom. They've both been adjunct faculty at the University of California Berkeley Extension Program, the California Institute for Integral Studies, and the JFK University. And then they're the authors of 101 Things I Wish I Knew When I Got Married, and their new book is called Secrets of Great Marriages, Real Truth from Real Companies About Companies, Real Couples About Lasting Love. Welcome, both of you. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
And I was telling you before we came on, one thing I promised our listeners, we're not going to talk about Tiger Woods or any of those celebrity marriages, because we're going to talk about real love and real couples, right?
Well, it's delightful. It's delightful to have so many authentically happy couples to interview. We had a ball interviewing them.
Well, they're
delighting in their relationships, and they were so happy to tell us about it.
Well, that's good. So how did you go about choosing these? First of all, I want to just say you two have been married to each other for 38 years, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be 38 in September.
Okay. Well, almost.
Almost.
Almost. Yeah. So tell us how you went about writing this book and what you were looking for when you chose the couples that you interviewed for the book.
Okay, I'll take a crack at that. We got the idea for the book actually several years ago when it became apparent to us that there were an awful lot of people out there that we knew either personally or they were clients or students in our courses who were really discouraged about the prospects of having a good marriage and were very pessimistic about the likelihood of that happening. And a lot of people felt that, you know, there just really weren't any good marriages out there, that the whole business of marriage was something that they just didn't see any point in getting involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that that wasn't the case, and we knew personally several couples that we felt qualified as great examples of what a good marriage can look like, because a lot of people don't even know what it can look like. They just know what they've seen, which isn't necessarily all that encouraging, or else they know what's in the movies and they know that that's not real.
Right.
So we
right.
wanted to write a book that featured actual couples who had been together a long time and had created something of real sustaining value for themselves, for each other, for their family, for their community, and in some cases for the world. And we started with several couples that we knew personally, and that we knew well enough to know that they would constitute qualified,
right,
fulfill the criteria that we had.
Right. You know, one of the things I really liked about this, Charlie, is that you did not set this book up with, you know, the 10 rules to follow or the 7 rules to practice.
No, that was deliberate. That was intentional.
Because everybody, at the end of the day, every single relationship is different.
Mm-hmm.
The dynamics are different. The personalities are different. But so this is really put together. 27 couples are featured in the book from their learned experiences. And the one thing that struck me through going through the book is that long-term relationships, whether it's a marriage or just a long-term relationship, because they end up being the same, is that it's on-the-job training.
Totally. Absolutely.
And, you know, these couples didn't come in with relationship charming from the beginning. And if you've read a few of the stories, you could see that some of them really did some significant struggling in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't mature. They didn't really necessarily live their values. They didn't have the courage to speak up and ask for what they needed. And so they had skills to learn, just like every couple has to.
Right.
And some of them struggled more than others. You know, some of them had temperamentally very compatible personalities, and others were more fire and ice. But I think having so much variety in the book shows the reader that it can look a lot of different ways. You know, there isn't any formula to
right.
make a great relationship. It's what two people agree to, roll up their sleeves, and get to work on it, and they keep co-creating and co-creating something that fits their needs.
Yeah, and one thing, story number 8, chapter 8, failure is an essential step on the road to success. I think so many people look at life in general from a black and white perspective, and we do have those gray areas in life. And as you were saying, it's what you're both willing to accept as okay, right?
Absolutely. And when you're able to meet what we call failures sometimes, with an openness to learn the lessons that are inherent in those experiences, then it's not a failure at all. The only failure is in either not making the effort in the first place or in not learning the lesson that was inherent in the experience. And we found that, like Linda just said, that these couples didn't come into the marriage with all of the skills and wisdom that are necessary to possess in order to create great relationships. They came in the way most of us come into relationships, which is, you know, pretty unaware of what those learning experiences need to be.
Mm.
And, you know, hopefully if you have an attitude of openness to learning, then there is no failure.
Right.
I think one of the best examples that shows taking a horrible breakdown and turning it into a breakthrough is the story about the Colemans. And if you'll remember the story, Drew Coleman was having a secret affair with his wife's best friend for a full year.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally confessed, and he was certain that the marriage was going to be over as soon as he told the truth about it. And she wasn't able to move or speak for 24 hours. When she finally came through and came out of the shock, she said, "Oh, no, we're not ditching this marriage. We're going to get to work on this." And they had to work long and hard. And, of course, he ceased and desist with the other woman, and they started to have some real communication that they hadn't had for years.
Right.
About how unhappy he was, and she was completely clueless. She thought that if he was unhappy, he would bring it to her attention, and he was just suffering in silence. And they completely restored the trust in that relationship, and then some.
Mm. And one of the stories, I'm thinking of Joseph and Robin White in the book, not their real names, but the title for that section is "A Painful Past Can Open the Door to the Deepest Love." Oftentimes we think of people who've had incredible pain in relationships as closing themselves off and, you know, carrying that baggage with them relationship after relationship. But you say that's not necessarily the case. It can't, you know, we can turn that painful past around and create a really deep love. So what are some of the steps we would need to do that?
Well, I think if we look at that story, one of the things that stands out for me, and it was an incredibly moving story to record as we were interviewing them, was Joseph's recognition of what he desperately wanted and what he was missing. And rather than staying stuck in anger and bitterness, which is the case with a lot of people, he strengthened his resolve to someday I'm going to have a person in my life that I can really express and receive love with. And that was a commitment that he made to himself, even as a small child. He refused to be broken by those dreadful experiences that he experienced, and was determined that he was going to have that relationship in his life. So the quality of commitment to really having a vision of what's possible, of what you deeply desire, and of being honest enough with yourself to admit what that is, even when it may seem difficult or unlikely to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
I think that vision and commitment are two very important aspects.
Mm. Well, you've interviewed a lot of people. I know throughout your work, you've been doing this a long, long time. And you interviewed a lot of people for the book, too. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you what you think is the most challenging issue that most couples face. That, you know, is there a common thing that most couples face, and how do they overcome it? And please stay with us. We're talking with Charlie and Linda Bloom. They are the authors of Secrets of Great Marriages, Real Truth from Real Couples About Lasting Love. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Does work feel like a puzzle and you don't know where all the pieces are, or you have all the pieces but you don't know what the picture should look like? Then join me, Denise Rubin, 30-year vet in human resources. I've sat in the boardroom and in the executive offices, and I'll share with you the trials and tribulations of the workplace and how together we can solve the workplace puzzle one piece at a time. Tune in to Work Does Matter, Fridays from 1 to 2 in the afternoon on Alternative Talk 1150. Visit my website at workdoesmatter.com.
Next Monday on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Beth Browse Scott shares her story from the frozen plains of Saskatchewan to the burning plains of Africa. Vicki also talks with memoirist Brenda Peterson about finding rapture here on Earth, and New York Times best-selling novelist Robin Hobb on Volume 1 of the Rain Wilds Chronicles. Please join us Monday at noon Pacific for an adventurous Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
This is Alternative Talk, 1150. Got it? Cool.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guests in this segment are Linda and Charlie Bloom. They are married. They've been married for almost 38 years to each other. They're also therapists who and put on workshops about relationships. And they've written this great book based on interviews with 27 couples who've been in long-lasting relationships about the secrets of great marriages, real truth from real couples about lasting love. And I said before the break, I wanted to ask you about, is there a biggest challenge that most couples face? And if so, what is that, and how do most of them manage to work through it? So let me throw that out to you and tell us what it is and how they do it.
There are two major areas. And the first one probably comes as no surprise to anyone, is that they have to find a way to deal effectively with their differences. Because differences are inevitable. Every couple is going to have them, and there is truth to that old adage about opposites attract. Charlie and I, when we teach our workshops, tend to refer to it as complements attract, that some deep part of us knows that we want to learn about the areas where we're not as adept, and so we're mostly unconsciously attracted to somebody who's quite different than we are. And then those same things that magnetize us to another person can drive us nuts. And those are the things that can create the conflict. So every couple has to find a way to listen well, to listen with respect, to make room for the differences, to not be a reaction machine, to respond, to negotiate for their needs, but to do it with grace and skill.
Mm.
The other issue that we find isn't as well defined in the literature as the conflict. You read a lot in the relationships book about the conflict management, conflict resolution. But this continuum that couples need to slide up and down about taking good care of self and then taking good care of other and being in tune with your own needs and meeting your own needs, and then being very keenly aware of what your partner's needs are and being able to meet some of those needs, not all of those needs, and keeping that in balance, continuing to put the corrections in. Usually there's one in the pair that's much better at taking care of themselves, so their stretch and their work to do to be eligible for a great relationship is more about generosity. Then there are other people, and they're usually attracted to each other, where their strong suit is to be generous and to care for other, and then their stretch and their growth is around paying more attention to their own needs and their own self-care. Because if you're too lopsided on one side or the other, the relationship is going to get in trouble.
Right, and we don't all grow at the same rates. I mean, sometimes we'll have a growth spurt, and then our partner might have a growth spurt.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I think it's important for couples to keep in mind is that when we are on different velocities in terms of our development, our growth, that sometimes one of us will seem to be ahead. And I say seem to be because it's not always what seems, what appears to be true isn't necessarily reality. It may just be your perception. But there are times when we're not exactly at the same level of growth or development or commitment in the relationship. And sometimes one person has to be willing to carry more of the weight. And so there's got to be a willingness to tolerate a certain imbalance from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
However, if it becomes an entrenched pattern and there's never any reciprocity, then that's a different situation.
Right.
You have to really deal with it.
Right. And there's a great chapter in the book called Great Marriages Require Both Partners to Be Teachers and Students. And I think that kind of sums that up a little, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about Chapter 9, Play is Serious Business, because I know so many couples who do not play and life is such a drudge. Talk a little bit about play and why it's so important in relationships.
Well, play is more than just a luxury that people who have a lot of time on their hands or children can indulge in. Play is an essential developmental aspect of our lives. The brain literally needs the kind of experience that play provides for us, which has to do with the enjoyment and the pleasure that we take in an activity simply for the sake of itself. In other words, it's not a means to an end. It's not something that we do in order to accomplish something, but we take pleasure in the experience itself. So it has more to do with an attitude that we bring than a particular activity. So you can actually make work playful, and you can make a game of tennis work.
True.
It really depends upon your attitude.
True.
And couples do tend to forget that it's just the relationship needs play as much as it needs anything else.
Mm. The one thing that I am focusing on this year for myself is not just in relationships, but in everything, is respect. Because I think in the past I've brought into my life people who can be a little disrespectful, and you know, and that can go both ways. So how important is respect in relationships?
I think it's huge. And what we found consistently with every single one of these happy couples that we interviewed, the level and the depth of respect that they had for each other was very deep. They had such admiration and such appreciation of each other. And they had such a belief in the other person's gifts, assets, traits, their passions. They drew them forth from each other because they looked at each other through what we came to call believing eyes. Sometimes they could see the greatness and the magnificence in the other person that they didn't even quite own in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And their belief was so strong that it overpowered the limiting belief that the other partner had and really drew their most wonderful self forward.
Mm.
So that level of positive regard and respect was across the board in the couples that we interviewed.
Now, we often hear about no-fault divorces, but you say the best way to avoid divorce is to have a no-fault marriage. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, what we mean by that is that it's very easy when things don't go according to plan, which is most of the time, to look at what you think the other person has done wrong that has created the problem. And so it's very easy to find fault or blame for the other person. And it's not that, you know, he or she may not be playing a part in it, but if we focus on what's their fault rather than looking at what we may have done to contribute to the situation and what we can do to correct the situation, then we're really likely to go down a very slippery slope. So having a no-fault marriage really means not being reactive to the compulsive impulse to blame the other person when things don't go right or when they don't go the way we want them to.
Right.
It means being more willing to take responsibility ourselves for what we can do rather than looking at what they did wrong.
Mm. I love, like Dr. Phil says all the time, and I love this phrase, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?
You have a choice. That's right.
You do have a choice.
You can have it either way.
Now, on the same vein there, is it, you know, we hear so much about we have to be open and honest and share everything. Do you believe that it's necessary to have full disclosure to have a successful and happy marriage?
You know, this is a very controversial subject, and I don't believe that every couple could practice full disclosure with a happy outcome.
Mm-hmm.
They do not have enough trust in their relationship to be able to take some of the secrets that people did some shadowy things in their past. They may have really learned a lot since then, and they need a little time between the actions that they did and what they're doing now. What we're advocating for, though, is not about confessing all things about your past, but staying current day to day, even moment to moment, about your experience and not concealing things that really have an impact on the relationship right here, right now. So that if people feel unhappy, that their needs aren't being met, that this isn't the vision that they had for the relationship, that they report out, but in a respectful way, in a constructive way, without blame, without making the other person responsible for it. And that's a different kind of a disclosure. That's just staying current so you don't end up with a mountain of incompletions that can end up coming down on your relationship like an avalanche, all those things that haven't been discussed.
Right. Makes sense. Now, we're almost at the end of our segment, so I'm going to ask you to give me a one-word answer, each of you. Doing this kind of work doesn't exempt you from personal challenges in your own marriage, but how would you describe the quality in yourself that has got you through those tough times in your own marriage? If you can give me like a one-word answer.
Resilience.
Resilience for Linda. And how about you, Charlie?
Honesty.
Honesty.
Honesty with myself and others.
Very good. And what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
If they want to find us, they can come to bloomwork.com at our website. And that way they can see the book, they can see our smiling faces and our pictures, they can see our workshops and where we are. And we're accessible to the public.
Fabulous. And that, again, is bloomwork.com. And Bloom is B-L-O-O-M, just like flowers in bloom, bloomwork.com. And the book is Secrets of Great Marriages, Real Truth from Real Couples About Lasting Love. And my guests again, Charlie and Linda Bloom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicki, for having us.
And thank you for listening in today. Appreciate it. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Next Monday on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Beth Browse Scott shares her story from the frozen plains of Saskatchewan to the burning plains of Africa. Vicki also talks with memoirist Brenda Peterson about finding rapture here on Earth and New York Times best-selling novelist Robin Hobb on Volume 1 of the Rain Wilds Chronicles. Please join us Monday at noon Pacific for an adventurous Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.